Well, good evening, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. You know, we continue to educate, inform, and provide stuff to you. It's not only how to make your life better, but to go back in the past and look what we can do for the future. A couple of weeks ago, we were started on the discussion with the 25th anniversary of Desert Storm, on discussion of what's going to happen and the ideas and concepts to put a national war memorial for Desert Storm up in Washington, D.C. And today, God bless it, we got the director of this whole project, Scott Stump. Scott, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, we're glad to have you. And Ray is along with us. He's another co-host for the program. I don't know if you guys ever met before. Ray goes back to Vietnam, as I do, and then I was in Desert Storm. Denise, our other co-host, was in both Vietnam and Desert Storm. So the memories and the ideas and the thoughts and how a memorial has an impact on everybody, I mean, it's very, very real. I mean, when we start out, when we look at the stuff here and I'm pulling up your website, they got six significant ideas that they came up with here. Historical significance of so many nations in the free world coming together for a common cause should be a focus of the memorial. The war effort was not a unilateral U.S. effort, but rather a multinational coalition of 34 nations. It was suggested the design include a roll call of the nations or 34 symbolic pillars. Number two, memorials designed should somehow reflect or recreate the desert environment where the war was fought. It might include a rippling sandstone wall or a sand dune-like element. All the names of the fallen should be engraved on the memorial. A gold star might be incorporated for each life that was lost. Number four, the memorial should include a lifelike statue of soldiers wearing protective masks and chemical warfare protective gear, or MOP gear. The memorial's design should illustrate the left-hook maneuver that was used to flank the Iraqi forces, and six bronzes of the campaign ribbons might be incorporated. Wow. Scott, how did you come up with six main themes like that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the one thing I want to stress is it's definitely been an evolution, and it's been something that it wasn't just five or six guys sitting around saying, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this or if we did that? What you're seeing on the website is a result of a very concerted effort to include other viewpoints and feedback. In fact, the architect firm, CSO Architects, are located up in Indianapolis, Indiana. I was referred to them through a trade organization, and they basically elicited feedback from veterans and family members over a very prolonged period of time, like 4 or 5 months, and they came up with those areas that need to be really stressed within this memorial. So there's been a lot of thought that has gone into this, and the feedback from veterans and their families is what you're seeing the result of.
That's pretty neat. When we come up to a war memorial, I mean, Ray, you and I have both been to the wall
right. A
bunch of times. Yeah. You and I both have friends on the wall. I know I've had the opportunity, Ray, I think you said you've had the opportunity to escort the moving wall when it's come through the community.
Right. Yes,
where does this take a veteran to, Ray? I mean, where does it take you?
Well, I'll tell you what, when the first time I went to the wall, and Scott, it's a pleasure being with you today, and I have great respect for what you're doing, but that wall has a living value to it almost. It was, I'm not sure how it's going to affect these guys, but when I saw names of my friends on that wall, it was almost like seeing them the first time in many years. And there had such a healing value to that thing. And you were able to stop, and you were able to talk, and you were able. And I was telling you, Doug, one thing we did, I kind of got our guys back together, and I had each one of them bring a little bag of dirt from their own houses, like Texas and California, where they came from. And at the wall, we poured it all into one bag, sifted it around, and we poured it out at the memorial. It was almost like a perpetual coming back together after all those years. And, you know, you're able to reconnect with each other a little bit, and it's got a lot of healing, and your family's able to be part of that, too. So I know you guys are looking forward to this, and I am, too, for you.
Well, Ray, I really appreciate what you said, and I'm sorry, Doug. I was just going to mention that it's really funny because a lot of people think Desert Storm, and they think of it kind of as standalone. However, there is so much linkage to Vietnam. I mean, all of our leaders were, and whenever I go around the country and do my you know, my speeches and informational sessions, I always give credit to, you know, the Vietnam veterans, who I really credit with us being able to come home safely. I mean, they were not going to let what happened the first time around happen to us. And I truly give our Vietnam veteran leaders all of the credit. And I think that our country really made a big, it was a real big turning point in our country at that point. And lessons learned in Desert Storm really helped to heal a lot of those wounds from Vietnam and the way that some of our folks, unfortunately, were treated, which was just absolutely unacceptable and horrific.
Well, that was true. That's really true.
I think, you know, one thing, again, Scott, I mean, Ray's familiar with this, and as you and I have talked, Scott, you might have learned, I know, in our command staff at Desert Storm, Bowers Raider and that 3rd MedCom, we were all Vietnam vets. The entire
Absolutely.
Group was a Vietnam, we were all Vietnam vets that had stayed in or got recalled back to duty. I mean, Colonel Bott, I think he was almost 60 years old at that time. One of the senior doctors, you know, a full colonel. And so we were able to tie together the knowledge and the experience that we had from Vietnam in a hope and a prayer and trying to train everybody up as we started Desert Storm, because I know with our group, when it all started running up and Iraq went into Kuwait, we immediately put together what we called the 4th U.S. Army CAT team. Command assistance team out of Fort Sheridan, Illinois. And they had all of us experts in the different fields, and we went around training units throughout the central part of the United States to get ready to go to war.
Right.
So from June, I guess we started preparing everything in June. And I'm going to repeat that. We started preparing everything in June, and then we were back on active duty in early July where we started preparing everything. And then from middle of August onwards until we actually got sent to the desert ourselves, we were 3 days a week, we were out training and preparing people.
Yeah. One of the things I did want to say, too, when we were talking about it, Doug, was the fact is that I think a lot of us felt abandoned when we came back home from Vietnam. And I think the Gulf War guys did the same thing. They felt a degree of abandonment. Because it was all over, you go back home, start life over again, which, you know, I was living two lives. One life was dying on the inside while the other one was trying to look normal. But I think when you get to a point of contact like the wall or a memorial, you're able to go back and you reconnect and you're finding some of your buddies. You make some of the organizations that Denise talked about. That's a great place to find people that will volunteer to be part of a movement or part of something that will give back to the men you serve, men and women you serve with, and the country. And I think it's a great pivoting point. Like you said, I think it changed everything, and it will do it again.
Scott, when you began this, you got a whole bunch of questions you started asking here. And the first question, I know we all of us can have a different opinion on that, and we can all state it and read it and write it forever. First question, I think this is critical to everything, because I got to reflect on Vietnam, and Ray and I have done this, and Ray, you did it in your book, and I've done it in my writings. Number one, what do you believe was the most historically significant or important accomplishment of Desert Storm War? What did you find with the answer to that question, Scott?
You know what? I'll tell you, that's a great question. I think it's also a really difficult question because there are so many dimensions and so many different directions we could look at. We could look at it from what were the major or the most significant accomplishments for our country or the world at large? And I would say first and foremost that we liberated a country. And I think a lot of times people, you know, think, oh, okay, great, we liberated Kuwait. That's kind of cool. And it stops there. And I kind of took it for granted myself up until about 3 years ago. A friend of mine and myself participated in the Memorial Day parade in Washington. And we're standing there. We had our camouflage, chocolate chip camouflage bottoms on. Group of Kuwaiti kids came up, weren't even alive when Desert Storm happened. But they came up, they shook our hands, and they said, thank you. And what they said next really floored me. They said, if it weren't for you guys, right now we'd be Iraqis. And it really hit me between the eyes. It's like saying we could be Canadians or we could be Mexicans or South Americans, whatever. We liberated a country. We did the right thing. and what those folks went through, and I think this is a very under-examined part of the whole Desert Storm war, was the fact, what did those people go through during those 7 months of occupation? And to be able to finally liberate them and restore them to freedom is remarkable.
That's one of the interesting parts, and I know both Ray and I have discussed, and it's, Ray, it's a theme through your book, what's the real meaning of war? I mean, when we look at Desert Storm, I know the perspective I had from the medical command, and then we were chasing around doing all the NBC training. I mean, Bowers Raiders was it. And then having to clean up the friendly fire. I mean, as you mentioned, again, the majority of the casualties that we had in the U.S. side and across everybody were friendly fire.
Right.
You know, for me, that hole in my heart, having to scrape and clean those guys up is, I mean, it'll never heal. I mean, Ray, it's like you, when your unit got wiped out, it'll never heal, right?
Right. No, it won't. And you kind of, but you have to get at some point where you draw a line in the sand and you say, I'm not going to let my past determine my future, so you have to move forward. But you'll never get over it. And what you try to do is allow it to maybe promote you for going forward and maybe doing something greater than what you could have done, and using those men and women as a catalyst maybe for helping us to be better men and better Americans and better husbands, fathers, everything, you know. So I've tried to allow it to do that for me.
I think that's the key thing here, because I think, Scott, each one of us will come up with a different reason and a different purpose and a different thought or a different idea. And what was it for us? But that's an internal, personal thing, I think, almost to a degree. I mean, it has to be. There's no other way it could be around.
One of the things, going to war, Doug, when you talk about what is war, you know, in my mind, it was like, hey, this is pretty cool. You know, you get dressed really cool, and you're going to be shooting at people. But then when I got there, I found out people were shooting at me, and it changed the whole dynamics of everything. And I don't think I knew what war was or even have an inkling of what it was until I really experienced it. And you see the degradation of what war does to people. And all of those things are impacting your life. And I think there's a certain closet for things that we shove in there. And we do have to deal them from time to time. We have to deal with those things because it is part of who we are. We went over there and we wanted to do a good thing. We wanted our lives to count for something. And sometimes bad things happened. And when you come back home, it, I think I'd do it all over again, but I might try to do a little bit better at it this time. But some of you Vietnam guys had a chance to do it over, and you did. You made us proud. So I appreciate you guys, what you've done.
Scott, what were you involved in? What did you do during Desert Storm?
I was actually I was in the Marine Corps, and I was with the 3rd Battalion, 24th Marines, and we actually did a little bit of everything. Our battalion did everything from, doing the combat patrols. We guarded ammunition dumps. There's a lot of concern about sabotage with all of the armament that were there, the 500-pound bombs, 1,000-pound bombs, you name it. Guarded flight lines. We did, POW duty. I mean, you just name it. It was all over the board. We moved around quite a bit, but mainly right along on the eastern shore of Saudi Arabia, as well as Bahrain at one point.
Well, there's your type, Scott and Ray. You guys are both Marines.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Semper Fi, Scott.
Semper Fi, Ray.
Yeah. I was with 3rd Battalion, 3rd Regiment, 3rd Marine Division in Vietnam, and we operated up on the most northern 15 miles of South Vietnam, and we were a blocking force to stop the NVA from coming south. And Colonel Oliver North and I served together in combat, and he told me one time, he said, we must have done pretty good because they started going through Laos and Cambodia rather than coming down where we were. And I don't think they were afraid of us, but they were afraid of our backup air cover and artillery and all those type of things. So, I don't think I would ever wish it on anybody else, but I'm glad I did that.
Scott, envision the wall and where it'll be, I mean, give us some idea of where Area 1 is. I mean, you guys have been working on it and coming down to a thing. Give us an idea of, where this will be and what it will look like.
Sure. Well, as far as what it looks like, we have a preliminary design, of course, and a lot of that is dependent upon the vetting of the various commissions and so forth that we have to deal with in Washington. But as mentioned, we came up with the rendering as a result of the feedback from folks. They can see it on our website, ndswm.org or National Desert Storm War Memorial.org. And it has that left hook element, you know, in it that's very, very apparent, you know, once you see that. But as far as the location, we've actually just had some really great news in the last couple of weeks. We had a meeting with the National Capital Memorial Advisory Commission. Let's see you say that 10 times fast. And they gave us a favorable ruling or a recommendation for Area 1 placement. And Area 1 is, if you can kind of think of a circle, and as you go out further, the numbers get higher. Area 1 is going to be in closest to the other memorials. And we felt very strongly that it was very, very important to tie everything together and that people would be able to visit one memorial to the next and to the next. And, you know, we're very excited about that recommendation. We've narrowed it down to a couple of sites at this point. One is on the Washington side. The other is on the Arlington side. And I've got to be honest with you, I'm biased toward the Washington side just because we think it's really important for folks to be able to walk from one memorial to the other rather than having to cross over onto Arlington. Arlington's beautiful. However, it is a little bit disjointed with the other war memorials, and we've felt from the very beginning, and as our design chair always says, where else does a war memorial belong other than next to other war memorials? I think he's got a point.
Yeah. And when I look at the design here and looking down, it almost looks like a seashell. It reminds me of a conch shell. And so you're looking in, you're walking in, and you're working on a spiral path down into the center. And Desert Storm, I know when we were putting it together and trying to figure out the left hook was incredibly important. But the Marines, I know, and Scott, as you understand, you guys charged right up the coast. I mean, Marines went right up the coast, bang, right up, you know, Kapsha right up the coast and on in. And so the different experience I think that each unit had, from what I saw and what I heard at the command staff and then going to pick up the pieces, was like night and day.
I bet. Can't even imagine. And, you know, you being as mobile as you were, seeing all these different areas, you know, I remember my little corner of the world, our little corner of the world from, you know, from our battalion, and you kind of got to see a lot more of a broad-based perspective.
Ray and I both explained some things of what our hopes and dreams are. You know, as we put this together, I mean, at the Vietnam Wall, I mean, Top, he's long gone, but I don't know if you ever got to meet Top. He was an incredible sergeant major. He worked at the wall forever and ever and ever. I know when I was up there and test fighter lectured or went up for things to say, that stayed with him at his house down in Arlington. But it was just totally, totally unique. How or what can we hope for when a person goes to visit the wall?
You mean as far as going to the Desert Storm Memorial once it's completed?
Correct.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, I think you have a couple of things going there. Obviously, first and foremost, is to remember the human sacrifice and to know that, hey, you know, there were, you know, about 300 Americans that did not come home in a fairly short period of time. I mean, you take a look at how long, you know, the time period was. That's a fairly substantial number. And even if it was one person, we would feel that it was very important to remember that. We also think that when they go there, that folks from around the world, and I didn't know this until the last year or so, but there are over 20 million visitors to Washington, D.C. that are tourists that are there kind of looking around. We hope that a lot of those are from overseas. So we would hope that those people would be able to see that. Also realize that, you know, this was a cooperative effort, which, it was 34 countries, including the U.S. I like to kid a lot and joke around when I go around the country and say, you know what, We had 34 countries that came together and accomplished something very, very significant, substantial, and important. We can't even get 34 states to agree now. I mean, think about it. We had 34 countries that came together, including Syria and Egypt. They were part of our coalition. So I would hope that people would be able to look at that and be proud if they are a country or come from a country of the coalition, as well as really be see how remarkable it was to have everybody come together and work together. And I think the last aspect, certainly not the the only or the least, but the educational component, Doug, I think is so important. 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when we're all gone, people need to understand how important Operation Desert Shield and Storm was, what it accomplished, and they need to remember all of those that served and the sacrifice. And, you know, the thing that Ray has, I keep hearing the common theme over and over again, it's that service, it's that sacrifice that every veteran is willing to put out there. We all signed a dotted line, knowing full well that, it might be the end of us. We're not all asked to make the ultimate sacrifice, but every veteran is willing to do that. And I think that our folks that did that and stepped up need to be remembered 50 and 100 years from now.
I think one of the things, and for me the hardest thing, and we've talked about this because Ray and I experienced this in Vietnam, and then a handful of Denise and I don't know how much you have, but our group, we've experienced it horribly from Desert Storm. The overall abandonment of the military and the wounded, the ill, the sick veteran, I mean, whether it's physiological injury or a psychological injury, has been a hallmark from Vietnam through Desert Storm to the current time. And in a sense, what I hope and I dream, and Ray and I have talked about this, and it's a theme from Ray's book and the theme of our program, as Ray has said, is how do we go forward from here? We can't change the past or what happened in the past, but we can learn from the past, and we can acquire lessons, and we can acquire wisdom, and we get a vision of what can be done better so that we don't end up in the same place in the future.
Well, there were so many masses of people involved in the Gulf War II, and a lot of them came back, and they didn't know they were bad off at the time, but then it began taking a toll on them over the years, and they really struggled trying to get help from the VA in different places because they were pretty much discounted. If you weren't in combat, then you don't have anything to say, and if you weren't wounded or... Well, these guys were wounded in a lot of different ways, Doug, and we talked about it like that, about the biological problems and the chemical problems and all these things that these guys were breathing, and it took a toll over time, and not only them, but there were families. But I was thinking, at the memorial itself, it'd be a great place for even organizations to have people there to give out literature or something that will help these guys to find not only answers to their problems, but maybe avenues to find answers to their problems. And it also gives them a voice, too. And I just think a point of contact where you can get people together and they can exchange the memories and the ideas and places like that, maybe even a place where they could sit down and just reflect or something. I don't know how you would do it, and I haven't seen the pictures of the memorial. But I was thinking, part of the healing, Scott, I'm a chaplain also, and I read the Bible for about 30 years. I've been studying that. And at the Pool of Bethesda, people went there, and it was a place of healing when the waters and something about it, reflecting. I think people do that at the near the memorial. There is a reflecting pool and different things at the memorials. And, I think there just has to be a place where people can get answers and get healing and be maybe contacted by organizations that are willing to help them, like you and Denise were talking about, Doug. And it's just a great place. It's going to be a good place to go and maybe find some answers to all the questions we have. And I think that's a positive thing.
Scott, one of the things that's come up, and again, as Ray has just reiterated again, what we do not have any centrally located place where artifacts and items are collected from the warrior.
Right, yeah.
I know for both Ray and I mean, we've got stuff going back to Vietnam. We just buried one of our colonels here on Monday. which was really painful. I mean, Sergeant Rollo called me on Saturday and said the colonel died. So we went to the funeral on Monday, and it was over at the Danville National Cemetery in VA in Danville, Illinois. And, I mean, obviously put our uniform on, the whole thing. I mean, it was really strange. My God, I can still get into my dress blues, and I got those things 30 years ago. You know, it's like, what's happening here? But the idea and what flowed back to me is what the colonel had done, what he had contributed, what his life had become afterwards. And it was just, when you sit there and you have to reflect on that and you look and go, oh my, this is what the guy did, but it ended here. And then here's what the guy did, and it began here.
Well, I think we all have choices. And when you come back from war, a lot of times, you go back in the same routine, and some things did change while you were gone, even family situations, and just a lot of things changed. And when you come back in, there's always a tendency to just go back and start life over and you know, wherever you're going to be at. But I think a lot of us, I know that I did, Doug, I didn't have a lot of people out there encouraging me. And when I go and talk to Marines and sailors at Camp Lejeune or Army at Fort Bragg or somewhere, I'm always trying to give them information that nobody ever gave me back when I needed it, when I was 20, 21 years old. And so I'm trying to give them solutions to things. And I tell them a couple things. I tell them, you cannot allow your past to determine your future. You can't. The only difference between me and the people I admire are the choices I make. And I have to choose my friends wisely, because who I hang around, I'll probably end up like them. And so I try to give them some positive things to get them moving, not just where they can find a job, but where they can find a better job and how they can have a better life. They serve their country. They deserve to have a good life. And it's not by the disability you get from the VA, because you're going to work for that disability, and they're going to put you through a lot of hoops and maybe put you on medications, which is going to stymie some of your, you know, some of the things in your future. So if we could just get more information to them, and these guys are getting older now, Doug, I mean, but they still, a lot of them are still maybe hung up on some of the bad parts. But I think the wall is going to be a very positive place if we can use it for those reasons. And I'm looking for what's going to happen with that. Moral injury is a major part in the people that I deal with, because of things either happened to them from other people, or they did certain things. And they have to deal with that, not only post-trauma, but also moral injury. And then the physical effects that came from the Gulf War, these guys don't even realize some of the stuff happened in their lives. And they just need more information and more positive people to give them more direction.
Scott, you got here on the fifth thing that you came up with, five questions you did surveys. Please share any thoughts, stories, letters, photos, or artifacts that you wish. You guys must have a treasure trove already.
Well, you know, there's always room for more. But, yeah, we do. And, you know, the thing that's amazing, Doug and Ray, is the fact that we all saw this through different sets of eyes, depending on what uniform we happened to be wearing, where we were located, what our job was. And we feel that that's an important part of telling that story. And, you know, as Ray was talking, I couldn't help but really be reminded, as I talked to our Desert Storm veterans across the country over the last 5 years, and really a little bit more than 5 years now since I initiated this process or this mission, the one common theme always comes back. They all tell me, you know what, I might not be anything special in life now. I'm just a working guy. I'm trying to pay the bills. I'm trying to raise my kids. I'm trying to be a good citizen. But that was the one time in my life where I really felt like I was a part of something important. Right. And it was bigger than me. And you know what? I think that's the whole reason why we're here on this earth is to, you know, to be involved and to make a difference and to be involved in something that's bigger than just ourselves. And that's the one common theme that I've heard over and over again over the last 5+ years.
In the future, and Ray, you have to help me because you wrote the book on this. In the future, when you go back to look at this and the memories come flying up, I mean, obviously this thing's going to happen, which I think is incredible. And hopefully we'll all be around and we can be there at one point or another. But I know for the wall or the moving wall, I know when we've gone to the moving wall, one couple times I went by myself, other times I went with a loved one. Most of the time I want somebody else that was there. Because it can be an emotional ride beyond anything imaginable.
Exactly.
How do you describe that, Ray? I mean, your wall, you lost most of your units on that wall. You lost most of your unit on that wall.
Well, it's there was a lot of them. We lost the platoon that day out of 48. We took 42 casualties. And I had cut two guys in my squad, in my part of squad. I had six of us left, and a couple of those guys had been wounded, but they hit them. They didn't tell nobody because they didn't want to leave the bush right then. And, you know, I told them, get on the chopper, and they wouldn't do it. But, you know, we didn't. We thought we lost more than what we did, but we did lose everybody because there was never any contact with anybody again. And the last time we saw them, they had head wounds and chest wounds and, you know, everywhere. They were bloody from head to toe, some of them. And so you assume the worst, and so you do lose your whole family in one day. But George Santayana said it, and I'll put it in my words. He said, if you forget your past, you're destined to repeat it. But it was another saying in the martial arts that said one time, if you dwell on your past, it will rob your future. So you don't want to forget it, and you will never forget it, but you just cannot allow it to cripple you the rest of your life. You have to move forward, and you have to do the best you can. I'll tell these young Marines, you'll never not be a United States Marine or United States sailor, whatever you are, or United States soldier, airman. You're going to be that the rest of your life, and people will look at you, and you should be a leader. Whatever you're doing, you do as good a job as you want to do in the military, and it trains you how to be a leader. You take the front. If nobody else is going to do it, you do it. Whatever's right, you do that because you're upholding not only a name but a tradition. And I think it would challenge all of us just to be a better person because we're going to have that name. He's going to be a former Marine or a former soldier or, Doug, my uniform do not fit me any longer. I don't even know if they make the size for mine anymore. So I told you one time I've studied martial arts for 25 years. And at one time, I thought, well, I think I'm going to take up sumo wrestling so I could eat what I want. But I'm still at 200 pounds. But, you know, it's like I don't think they make too many uniforms to fit me any longer. But I'll never not be a United States Marine. And that's one of the things that I do want to do. And I hear it all the time. They'll say, well, thank you for giving back. Well, I don't know how you call that, but I just feel a determination and maybe a push. And just like you do, Doug, that I want to help somebody along the way out there that's struggling. And there are so many out there. The other day I spoke at Camp Lejeune and a room full of Marines, and I went to sailors and all, but every one of them were on medications. And so I was able to, you know, speak on that and give them some help and try to get them, you know, in a normal way and in a doctor-prescribed way of how to get off some of that stuff because it's going to really cripple you in whatever you want to do. So that's the way, you know, I think we'll never not be in the military. We're always going to be part of that life.
You know, Scott, I know envisioning where you would describe it, and we've talked already, in which you just described the location where the memorial is going to be either on the Arlington side of the bridge or right there in the center from the Lincoln Memorial on out. I mean, one thing both Ray and I have had the pleasure of, I don't know if you've ever done it, we've been up there for Rolling Thunder.
Yeah.
There ain't no way to describe that. And
well,
I can almost envision this be a portion of that whole Rolling Thunder experience, couldn't you, Ray?
No. One time I was up there, it was over 900,000 motorcycles there. And usually it's in that neighborhood, 700 to up to 900,000. That's not counting the visitors. You know, I've seen a lot of visitors there. You could tell they're from other countries, the way they dressed and acted and talked. And you would think, they must think this is the biggest motorcycle gang they've ever seen in their lives because it's inundated with people who seem to care and they want to acknowledge those who served our country. And that's a very gratifying time for something like that.
Scott, where do we go from here?
Well, yes, yeah, that's a great question. I think that at this point we're eagerly looking forward to moving ahead with the site selection and getting the, you know, getting that site completely nailed down. Of course, we, in this 25th anniversary year, we are in the middle of a fundraising campaign. And I don't want to turn this into a fundraising drive, but unfortunately, it's all about fundraising at this point to, you know, to make it happen. And I'd just like to invite all of your listeners and everyone out there to, you know, to consider helping us make this happen. We have a goal of raising $25 million during this 25th anniversary year. And when you take a look at the cost of memorials, very, very reasonable, nothing over the top. In fact, our architect has a term that I think fits it very well. He calls it profound simplicity. We're delivering a profound message in a simple way that's not over the top. It's not audacious. It's not gaudy. It's a very respectful, tasteful way. So I just want to, you know, invite all of your listeners to, you know, feel free to, you know, to be a part. We'd love to partner with you financially, and you can do that several ways. You can do that, you know, through the website, National Desert Storm War Memorial.org. We have a very active Facebook page as well, Doug, that if you just search it by National Desert Storm Memorial, it'll pull up. You know, a lot of times people, it's funny, I don't know if you gentlemen have found this, but people sometimes are a little funny about money. You know, they start thinking, oh, gosh. And I like to put things in perspective. We're in a political season, and I just read the other day, I'm going to leave the candidate nameless so that we don't incriminate anybody, but they basically spent, what was it, like $38 million just in negative attack ads in Iowa and New Hampshire. I'm thinking $38 million, that's more than what, you know, a lot more than what we're looking for this memorial. And people don't bat an eye with these people raising hundreds of millions of dollars. It's gone. It's spent. It's over. Then you start talking about a memorial, and some people, not everybody, start telling you how much money that is. And I think it's kind of ironic the way that people look at it in terms of money. You know, something that's very worthwhile, it's lasting, it's forever, versus hundreds of millions of dollars in television ads attacking one another that's poof, it's gone, and it's over with.
Boy, you said it perfectly. I think when I'm looking here, and I'm looking at your website, and I mean, this really sums it up, Scott. I mean, I got to compliment you on that. The goal of the memorial's design is to create an educational, meaningful, and deeply moving sequential experience for visitors that, one, educates them about the historical events of the war. Two, identifies each of the coalition countries and illustrates the historical significance of the 34-nation coalition that was United to Liberate Kuwait. Three, memorializes all names of those Americans who sacrificed their lives in war. Four, reflects the unique environmental and battle conditions experienced by our servicemen and women in this war. Five, leaves visitors with enduring memory of historical significance and moral accomplishments of Desert Storm War. End quote.
That's amazing.
And Doug, if you don't mind me adding, I'd just like to say that I think whenever you have these anniversaries or birthdays that end with a five or a zero, we tend to reflect and realize just how short life is. And I just wanted to mention that as you were reading those through, you know, thank you for doing that, by the way. You're making my job real easy. But I think the main thing we've got to realize is that 25 years ago, even right now, 25 years ago today, it was still very uncertain. And people look back and they tend to look at Desert Storm and they kind of poo-poo it. Oh, it was a 100-hour war. It was nothing. I've even heard the term skirmish. I've seen that term used. I'm glad I wasn't in the same room as the person that said that. Well, if it's a skirmish, you tell that to the families that lost the loved ones. But I think that people really look at it as a speed bump in history. And that was the whole impetus for me why I started this process back over 5 years ago. I realized that if we didn't do something, this was going to be forever lost, and it would be relegated to a footnote in history. And I felt personally that it was way too important and accomplished way too much to be just relegated as a speed bump in history. We needed to remember all of this. It was very important, and it was a very uncertain time. And I think all you have to do is you have to look back at those tens of thousands of body bags that were standing at the ready, and they were very well, everybody fully intended that they would be used. I mean, they predicted a lot of a lot of casualties, and by the grace of God, you know, we got through it a lot better than what we ever could have imagined. So I just wanted to mention that I think people really need to remember just how uncertain it was, how it could have gone the other way, you know, and we really are very, very fortunate to be able to say that this was something that I always tell people, you know, the best war is never to have a war. That's the best case scenario. The best war is to not have one. But if you have one, I think this is probably as close to a template or picture perfect as you can get by having a clearly defined goal, executing it, and then getting out of Dodge. I just really, you know, feel strongly about that, and it's been validated to me time and time again over the past 5 years.
One thing that happened, I mean, the horror and where we were going to at the command staff and with nuclear, biological, chemical, what we were doing at 3rd MedCom, we knew Iraq had the chemical and biological weapons. We knew they were deployed. We knew they were weaponized. The horrific part is that they were given to them by the United States Army, end of story, in England, in Germany, in Russia. We knew they were there. We knew they had weaponized anthrax. So the weaponized anthrax was shipped to Iraq for use on the Iranians and the Iraqi Kurds by the Army out of Fort Detrick, Maryland. We got the shipping papers, end of story. We had all the ideas, so the chemical and biological was there. We did not have, and this is a horrific part, and I was involved in this, the ground war was held up until it was on the February 24th because we did not have the chemical protective gear or the medical supplies on station in theater for the ground war to begin. We did not have it. We had to get it in. We had units that came in there, thought there was a pompous location or supplies that somehow there was magic, like, well, the stuff they had at their unit was just practice stuff, and there was a go-to-war set that they'd given handed to them when they arrived. And that was wrong. There was no go-to-war set. You either had it or you didn't. And then the other thing, too, is with the intelligence, and this is where I ended up picking up the pieces, and I'm still picking up the pieces, the intelligence on the Iraqi armor and everything had them in basically undefeatable. Because of special stuff. So then we had to use depleted uranium, which, you know, my whole life has ended up, I don't know where I can go with this now. It's been a long ride. So we did not know. So when we're starting there in December, and thank God we had Bob Hope show that gave the command staff a relaxation for a few hours. We literally all went off over there and watched them, for me the third time, and in war. And we didn't know what was going to happen. So when we started the air war in January, and then we're building up to the ground war, I mean, we were on the final day. We were still teaching the command staff, doing the refresher course for nuclear and biological chemical warfare to the primary command staff, in the order from Schwarzkopf and everybody else, Pagonis and all the way on down, and Zulus and Yosakis, have the command staff back in their office at 1,300 hours on Saturday the 24th, and the colonel sent the message down. We finished the class at noon, 1,200 hours, and he sent them back, and he put the message up there, and this started the ground war. The message that went back up to Yosak and then to Schwarzkopf, everything is the train is on time.
Well,
a little piece of history, Scott, you may never ever heard about.
Well, I find it fascinating, and you know, as you talked about all of the people that have had, have this, the health issues as a result of their service, I can't help but think about those folks, too, that how many have had premature deaths who are living with these issues daily. So whenever I hear anybody say, and again, thank goodness they've not been in the same room as I have, well, there's only 300 people that died. yeah, it's crazy, but I always think to myself, yeah, but look at all of the other folks that have died early that are dealing with all of these issues. Those are the uncounted casualties. I really equate it, and this is no disrespect, but I equate it to the same as, you know, this is the Agent Orange of Desert Storm would be the Gulf Syndrome. And that's something that I don't bring up a lot, just for the simple fact that I don't want to cloud the issues. You know, we're about memorializing, and we even have some of our folks on our team that are dealing with this themselves, and we have all the sensitivity and respect to it. for sure, 100%. But boy, that's something I think is discounted a lot of times as far as the casualty counts go.
Yeah, the casualty count, what we do know today, out of the 640,000 that went there, we've got over 100,000 or died out of that 600-some thousand. And out of that number, the VA has totally acknowledged over 400,000 of the remainder Desert Storm people deployed are now in medical care or attempting to get optimal and prompt medical care at the Department of Veteran Affairs. That's a staggering casualty rate.
We're seeing the same casualty rate,
very low levels, wounded in action, killed in action, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom. But we're seeing the incredible, still horrific, in what we call that disease and non-battle injury, DNBI, casualty rates.
Doug, let me give one perspective. I heard both of you with perspectives, and I was back home when the Gulf War started. You know, 3 days war, whatever it was, that's the way it's supposed to work. But America was preparing. I know I was. I mean, when I heard it on the news that night that America's at war when they were bombing Baghdad or whatever, I mean, I know the emotions I went through, and I think most American people were doing the same thing. We were prepared. I mean, we were kind of preparing ourselves for 100,000 casualties or something going against, Hussein's army and, you know, guard and all this stuff, all the Russian tanks and everything he had. We were prepared. But I'll tell you something. America came together, and the first time in my life, I really felt like we were one nation under God, where churches were just calling each other and praying and asking people, pray for them. And I started a thing in my business where I had a picture of the Gulf War up on the wall, and it was sitting inside these two great hands, and it was saying, God has his hand on our guys, or our folks. And people were coming there putting their names on this list, and we'd take the list to church of the names, and people would volunteer to pray for them. You know, America really came together. The song came out, you know, I can't remember his name, but God Bless, or I'm Glad to Be American. I mean, it was the most patriotic time I believe I'd ever been in my life. And that's the way war was supposed to last. I mean, 3 days, that's a pretty good deal. And you only lost 300 people. That's terrible. But most of that was from friendly fire. It wasn't even from the enemy. So I think God did a great thing in that war of getting us out of that thing. I do think there was a lot of man-made mistakes that happened, and it did cause. But anytime you have after war, you're going to have casualties that show up years later, and that's happening. A lot of things just don't show up. They had Agent Orange on. You know, they sprayed us with Agent Orange. I was out in the bush up on the DMZ, and we thought it was mosquito repellent. We didn't know what it was. Nobody told us anything. They just say, don't look up. And they would wet you down with the stuff. And then at night you laid in the ground, and then we drank water out of bomb craters and places. We were drinking it, laying in it, being sprayed with it. And it really didn't show up. It did show up, but we didn't know anything about it until years later they came out with Agent Orange. It was like, and I went to the VA, and I inquired about it, and they showed me a map, and they said, man, you were one of the heaviest used areas. And I said, well, I'd had rashes for years. And they said, that's what it is, you know. So there are a lot of things that show up, but I remember our country pretty much came together for a while, and it was good. It was a good thing.
There's one thing that, and all of us seen this, I mean, there's a poster from the Vietnam War, and I think this symbolizes all of it. It's a soldier looking at the wall with his reflection in the wall, looking to the past and looking into the future.
Yeah.
And that's what the wall, I know, can do. I mean, for the Vietnam Wall, that's what it's done for me, and I know, Ray, it's done for you.
Yeah.
But I'm sensing, Scott, what you're telling us and what we feel, that's what the Desert Storm Memorial can do.
I think it absolutely will, Doug. And, I think Ray made a very spot-on assessment, and I tell people this, too, is the fact that give me the definition of the most successful war you can have other than not having one. Well, it's to complete it as quickly as possible with the fewest number of casualties. And I've had people from other countries that I've had discussions with, and they've told me, so why does America not want to talk about their victories? And I just kind of have to shake my head and say, I don't know. I really don't know. Or I guess maybe they're misguided. I'm not sure what that is, but that that is a lot of this whole education process that's involved with it. And I think it really will. I think that this is going to be a very healing for a lot of families, for a lot of loved ones, for those that serve. I hope that it gives them a place where they can feel a sense of pride, probably a lot of mixed emotions. But as we know, as we get older, we tend to forget about some of the bad stuff. I mean, for example, the coldest I've ever been in my life was in Saudi Arabia. People look at me like I'm crazy. But, you know, when you're getting that, when it's about 36 degrees out there and you're getting rain and just getting drenched, I forget about how miserable that was. And I start thinking about, you know, the people that you serve with. I think that's a lot of what it becomes. You know, you remember that, and you remember that camaraderie that you just don't have out in the regular world. And I think that those of us that have been fortunate enough to have been in uniform, you know, we're such a small percentage of the population at large. A lot of people can't appreciate this, but I mean, it's different. It is different. You can rely on a person to your left, you can rely on a person to your right, and you just don't have that kind of camaraderie out in the civilian world.
No, you don't. And that's one of the things about post-trauma that caused us so many problems, was the security and the closeness of people around you gave you a sense of security. I wish, I know you can't do this, Scott, but I wish there was some way, somewhere on that monument, you might put something about, this was a war that God helped us to fight. Because it only lasted 3 days with 300 casualties. And bad as that is, it could have been so much worse, man. And so...
It could have, and I agree, and I have absolutely no heartburn with that. Unfortunately, we're dealing with the federal government, and they're very sensitive to that. But as far as I'm concerned, personally, I'm a person of faith and belief, and I know that God's hand was on us. There's no way that we could have done what we did as quickly as we did and have the outcome that we did without His guidance and His protection. I absolutely believe and agree with that 100%.
Well, maybe
thank you, Scott. We do.
thanks to the prayers of the American people, we ended the war quick. Maybe that's a better way to do it. But there's a lot of Americans that would love to revisit that because they had good memories about it. And coming
that's
together
right.
And creating packages and doing different things. And it was like World War II to some people that were making shoeboxes and doing this and being active and serving their country. Even at, you know, there's a thing in World War II that said, they also serve who stand and wait. And it was a sonnet written by John something back in the 1700s or something. But it was a very applicable, they also serve who stand and wait. And America was serving while they were waiting. And we're glad you guys came back home. I'm sorry, man-made problems that existed, but man always messes up everything. I've been in places in Vietnam that it would look like no man has ever touched this place. It would be a beautiful waterfall out in the middle of a jungle somewhere. Then you see a empty pack of cigarettes float by. It's like man messes up everything he touches. So I go with that a lot of times.
Sure.
You know, we had a unique experience. I mean, at the end when the prisoner of war camps and they're setting up the hospitals for prisoner of war camps, we had the Swedish Army showed up, okay?
Yeah.
And we went over the command staff to meet them. It was my cousin.
Wow.
Boy, did I have a good Swedish breakfast.
Ray, you brought up a great point that I almost really feel sorry for the Iraqi freedom and enduring freedom folks because of the technology that they had. And I spent a little bit of time with the DOD in Baghdad back in 2006, 10 years ago. And I would always encourage these young soldiers and Marines, you know, hey, write, you know, it doesn't cost you anything. Write a letter home. 20 years from now, 30 years from now, your loved ones are going to keep that letter. They're not going to save an email. And they just didn't really get it because they're so indoctrinated with the technology. But I remember how much it meant to me, not only to get letters from loved ones, but we had a ton of them. It would be addressed to any service member. And I remember I took it upon myself to write back as many of those as I could. I'd open them up and I'd write them back and say thank you because it touched me so much knowing that a complete stranger wanted to wish us, you know, well and to show their appreciation. I was really touched by that, and a lot of us were.
And that should be part of a memorial. It really should be.
Yeah, I said that's what I mentioned in archives for all these things because as we get older, we don't have a need for them, but they're a part of history that should be there for the future to learn from and see and realize where we can go, what we have done, and where we can go.
Absolutely.
Well, You know, there are, you know, matter of fact, I said it last time, Doug, Westmoreland said after the war, he said, the next time you're not going to welcome them back home, do not send them. Well, the American military was welcomed back home after the Gulf War, and I think that was part of the Vietnam veterans of saying, we're not going to let this happen to you the way it happened to us, because we felt too abandoned when we came home, and we weren't able to talk about it or share it, and so a lot of us just stuffed it. And then the problem with that is, you know, there's something called suppressed stress. I don't know if you ever heard of that or not, but suppressed stress has a way of coming out somewhere and usually comes out in your, as pain in your lower back and your neck and when you're stressed out. But when you stuff things like that, it will come out eventually. One of the guys I served with in Vietnam about 20 years after Vietnam, he told me, when I got up with him, he said, I came back home, and he said, I shoved everything I had in a closet, in an invisible closet, and he said, I pretend like it never happened. And so I went to work. He got married in Hawaii, actually, on R&R, and he said, I just went back to work. And 20 years later, he was sitting in a chair in the living room, and he imagined that he heard a helicopter. And he said, I went into a nervous breakdown, and I thought I was dying. And he suffered with that. So, you know, I'm so glad the American people did support you guys and they did welcome you back home. And it's only been years, Doug, since I've learned some of the bad things that happened with the chemical and biological mistakes that affected a lot of people that we didn't know about. Nobody ever told us these things. And I'm sorry for those things, and I want to help you guys any way I can. So thank you, Doug. And
Scott, you get the closing statement here.
Sure. Well, I just want to thank you gentlemen again, you know, so much for having me. And it's an honor, and I look forward to building this memorial for all of our Desert Storm veterans.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Ray. God bless America. Take care of our veterans, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.